what day it is. Guess what day it is. Huh? Anybody? Julie, hey, guess what day it is. Oh, come on, I know you can hear me. Mike. What day is it, Mike? Listen, guess what today is.
It's hump day.
Woohoo! Hump day!
I see a clinic full of cynics. Twist the people's wrist. They're watching every move we make. We're all included on their list.
Stacking cash, got the juice so mad. Sipping on hate, he gotta be feeling bad. Gripping the stacks, watch him go insane. Anger overflowing, he's playing no games. Ain't no stopping now, he's on a rampage. Madness in his eyes, the fury takes the stage. The juice be boiling like a fire so wild. Flood got him heated, feeling hostile and wild. Gripping that paper, making juice seethe. A tornado of anger about to release. He's got that madness flowing through his veins. Every ounce of rage consumed by the flames.
Flood got the moolah. He's living large, but the juice is mad. He's feeling charged. No more chowing down on creepy crawlies. Stacking paper, making moves, the juice rallies. Mad juice in the house can't be contained. Money's gonna flow, blood's gonna sustain. No more bugs, full
punch, the juice is gonna pull through. Watch out, world, the maddest juice is coming for you.
Talmud says, I don't give a shit what he says.
I love it. The Jews clearly control the media and the banks. Investment banks, not the commercial ones. But the point is, they carry out in those realms the exact same principles that they display in sexuality. They undermine traditional life, and they deracinate society. Deracinate. Tear out the roots. The real people derives its genius from the land, from the sun, from the sea, from the soil, you know? This is how they know themselves. But, like, Jews don't even have soil. Those aren't Jews. No, just the Israelis. It's a fundamentally secular society. They no longer need Judaism because they have soil, because the real Jew is a wanderer. He's a nomad. He's got no roots and no attachments, so he universalizes everything. He can't hammer a nail or plow a field. All he can do is buy and sell and invest capital and manipulate markets, and, you know, it's like all mental. He takes the life of a people that's rooted in soil, and then he turns it into this cosmopolitan culture based on books and numbers and ideas, and, you know, this is his strength. You can take the greatest Jewish minds ever. Marx, Freud, Einstein, what have they given us? Communism, infantile sexuality, and the atom bomb. In the mere 3 centuries, it's taken these people to emerge from the ghettos of Europe. They've ripped us out of a world of order and reason. They've thrown us into a chaos of class warfare, irrational urges, relativity, into a world where now the very existence of matter and meaning is in question. Why? Because it's the deepest impulse of a Jewish soul to pull at the very fabric of life till there's nothing left but a thread. And when nothing but nothingness, nothingness without end.
Wow. The rising frequency of anarchist and communist violence in the streets can lead in only one direction: discontent and a rising white proclivity toward violence on their own behalf. The time for talk has long since passed, as has the time of intellectualism. Action is what is needed most in these trying times, and that action must be driven towards our white revolution. Do not get bogged down with the nostalgia for days gone by. Instead, channel that nostalgia into action. Bring about that glorious world that could have been through revolutionary action. It is an honor that we should live in such times that the existence of our people rests upon our shoulders is the most supreme of gifts. Times like these are what birth heroes. The moment you feel any fear or doubt, strike it from your heart. Understand that if it is not us, it will be no one. Embrace the chaos, and from its ashes, a new world shall arise, beautiful and pure, to victory, white man!
Thank you. ass inspirational message. Fuck the Jew.
White America, wake the fuck up. White America, wake the fuck up.
Yes, white America, wake the fuck up. White Canada, wake the fuck up. White England, white Scotland, white Ireland, white Germany, white France, wake the fuck up. Hello, everyone. This is the Sane Asylum Based Hump Day, number 316. It's April 9th, 2025. I'm your host, Giuseppe Vaffangulo, and unfortunately, you're going to be watching this on FTJ Media as a replay later in today, because right now there's a major upgrade going to the servers and everything. So thought that would be done by now, but it wasn't. So you're tuning in on Honor to be on whitepilled.tv and, of course, Twitter X. Good to see you. And we are now joined by two amazingly compelling thinkers, Dr. Carl Rottle and my dear brother from FTJ, Flood. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you? Let's start with Carl and see how you sound, Carl. Let me see if I'm unmuting you on my side. Now, how are you, Carl?
Oh, I'm good. How about you?
Good, and you sound great. This is really cool. So it's an honor to meet you. I'll tell you, when I was doing show prep last night, I'd heard your name in the past, but I never really researched your work. And it's to my detriment that I hadn't done it, because you've been doing this for nearly a decade publicly. And I was just blown away by your Substack. In fact, so much so that I became first time I've actually joined a paying Substack, because your work is just amazing. So look forward to hearing all about that. And Flood, how are you today?
Giuseppe, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here with yourself and with Mr. Rattle. I'm sorry, yes. Dr. Rattle. Let me.
Dr. Rattle, yes, a man of letters for sure. All right, let me share screens here real quick so we can show Dr. Rattle's Substack real quick, and as well as his Twitter. But while I'm doing that, you know, one of the things that I thought was very interesting in one of your interviews, and I was telling Flood before the show that last night when I was doing show prep, I listened to three full interviews between Flood and Carl, and it was just riveting, just so interesting. And so my first question I'd like to start out with is, you had mentioned, and part of the discussion was, history repeats in stunning regularity. And so right now it seems like it's lining up to have Trump's second term be more of a the presidency right before a great economic collapse. I mean, it's interesting that he's trying this tariff thing. I don't know. It seems like that's for a simpler time, economic time. And with everything going on now, it's certainly seems to be President Hoover. That's the name I was looking for. So your thoughts, Carl, and then we'll go Flood. And here's my co-host Scorpio's here. Great to see you, Scorpio.
Oh, hey, guys. Sorry to be on CP time again. Good to see you guys.
Okay, so let's so Carl, your thoughts on history repeating, especially with Trump's bold tariff move?
Well, historically, yeah, history always tends to repeat itself. It always repeats itself in different forms, in different ways, in different conditions, but it always repeats itself in some way or another. That's because you're dealing with humans. You're not dealing with, like, you know, spirit beings that don't sure. have anything to do. It's just kind of how we are. But in terms of it repeating itself with Trump, it's a classic thing, really, because we get to the point of an end of an empire or close to an end of an empire, and radical change has to happen. Things begin to have to come down. The same is true of Weimar Germany, when they were busy in crisis for years and years and years. Britain went through various different versions of this at different times in its history. Other countries have done the same. Ancient Rome went through it multiple times, and through periods of degeneracy and renewal. And Trump is very much, to my mind, being one of these people who is kind of, for lack of a better term, he has become a lightning rod for a lot of the issues that were extant in the US prior to, well, sort of really, really prior to his coming, like really from the 90s to 2000s to back to the 80s and 70s and 60s. But we'd never really gotten to the point where like society was really breaking down, because even the swinging 60s, society didn't really break down.
Oh, not at all.
It just had a very loud bit of it with the hippies and the riots and so forth. So yeah, I think we're going to that phase where where everyone has stopped caring about what the courts think. It's one of the concepts that Peter Pulser brings out in regards to Germany in the 1920s and Weimar that people don't often know about, is that prior to that, the anti-Jewish and the nationalist movements were often stopped by lawfare, by Jewish groups. But then in the 20s, no one cared what the locals thought anymore, so they didn't care about being sued anymore. Jews didn't adapt their strategy, and they ended up with the Third Reich. So, and that's a similar thing is going on. No one cares anymore about the courts. No one cares what the state thinks per se, because people have lost faith in it completely. It's an interesting parallel.
That's a great point. Oh, I'm sorry, I jumped in a little too early. Flood, your thoughts, and then we'll go to Dave Scorpio.
You know, thoughts are a very strong word. I'm confused most of the time with the way things are going, and I tend to look at things with a little bit of some degree of panic and dismay. But when Carl puts things in perspective, it kind of turns that around, doesn't it? Like I kind of tend to see the immediate collapse on the horizon, but without the historical context of knowing what came after, you know, in the past, a person could be very, very dejected and very black-pilled. But now I kind of go about things with I don't want to say wait and see, but with a very reserved, unease, but no more panic, no more doom, just let's see what happens next and to try to be ready for anything.
Great point. Dave Scorpio, your thoughts? I know you probably dropped out, missed a little bit. In one of Carl's interviews with Flood a few months ago, he was talking about the tendency for history to repeat. And then Carl mentioned just a few moments when you dropped out that, humans are human, and so they repeat the same mistakes. And so what are your thoughts on this tariff thing? I know on previous shows you said that you thought, it potentially be a good thing. But right now, to me, it's ironic that the boomers who and the MAGA types who back Trump are now seeing they were herded into 401ks, into the kosher casino stock market, and now they're seeing their retirement and their savings drop precipitously. Now there's always the chance that there'll be this huge rally and their money will be put back, because the old chestnut, until you take it out of the kosher casino, it doesn't matter how low it goes. It's just, so your thoughts, Scorpio?
Well, the market's dropped about 10%. And look, the stock market is a completely phony entity. It's a kosher casino now. And it's actually the cause of a lot of inflation. No one talks about the stock market causing inflation because it's so wildly out of control. Anyone that has studied the market over the years, already knows that all the market fundamentals, as they say, are completely out the window, and it's just been rising, rising, rising. And so, look, I'm one of the few people that actually think that tariffs are the only way to even begin to bring back any kind of manufacturing or any kind of nationalist thinking back to the country. But I'm pretty convinced now this is all going to be sabotaged. This is one of the few things Trump is actually trying to do that might actually benefit the country. That and deporting, all these illegal aliens, which now they've been granted, they have the right to due process. So that's pretty much over with now. If you start giving due process to illegal aliens, it's going to take years and years and years. Right. Trump will be long out of office before any substantial number is ever rounded up and thrown out of the country. But I believe the tariffs are going to be, this whole thing's going to be sabotaged. This drop in the market is intended to scare people. And if you look at all the negative press this is getting by the mainstream media, Your Xbox is going to cost more. Your iPhone will cost more. You know, but someone tell me any other way to start to bring back one, any kind of nationalist thinking. And America is so sunk down into Jewish consumerism and what, you know, sensible pleasure can I get at the moment rather than caring about the country or actually having a real economy based on making things. If you don't manufacture things, you don't have a real economy. So, but I'm convinced this is all going to be sabotage. And I think they're setting us up for a big morality play about how dangerous nationalism is and how important free trade is. It's the only way to go forward. And it's just going to, I believe this will be total sabotage all the way through.
Those are very good points, Dave. So, Carl, I was interested in, I've been researching your presence on the internet, and you go back almost a decade where you used to have a website and you were doing some interviews with excellent shows like the Deanna Spignola and what have you. And I'm curious, and because you are a PhD, and it was remarkable, I heard you say to, I thought I was doing a good job my whole life. I try to learn a new word every day, even to present now at 65 and a half years old. And, but you read a book a day and I'm like, he won. And so not that it's a competition, just a joke. And so, how did you go from being on the typical, academic, path of, you know, getting your bachelor's, master's, and then, presenting your thesis to get your PhD. And then the gold ring of every PhD is to become a tenured professor somewhere. And so how at that point, and where at that point did you realize the Jewish question was more like a Jewish problem, which is then based on reading some of the things you have to say, is more like Jewish parasitism. When, tell us about your awakening to this existential threat.
So your research on me is right to a degree, but your timing is off. And it's not your fault of yours. It's just that Carl Radler as a moniker only goes back about a decade plus.
Oh, okay.
I've been around the radical right since I was 18.
Oh, fantastic.
So I was red-pilled by the old-fashioned way by two books, which was Glade Whitney's Race, Genetics, and Society, and Roger Pearson's Race, Intelligence, and Bias in Academia. And so Whitney said something in the middle of his book, which kind of really caught my notice. He said very bluntly that, oh yes, Ashkenazi Jews and Jews in general have specific genetic markers. And that I remember that moment because that was the moment where I thought, hang on a minute. How can a religion have genetic markers? That doesn't make any sense. So then I went through my own radicalization journey for a few years in the OOs. And then I was doing my undergraduate degree at that point, my first undergraduate degree, actually. And then I went off and I was kind of doing my own research on the Jewish question because I wanted to understand things. I read a bunch of books about it. And was trying to understand a lot of things to do with it and argue with people on the internet as you do about stuff like that. And over time, I decided I wanted to do academia as my profession. I got my PhD, my master's, and I did my graduate work. And I was all in the background. I was doing work in regards to what I wanted to do. What I actually wanted to talk about, which was the Jewish question. And it was kind of at this time in the OOs when there wasn't a lot of people who talked about this in, I would say, a sane way, without sounding awful, because a lot of the stuff that had been was kind of being used was really from the 50s, 60s, and sometimes 70s, and the voices that you heard were older research. Some of it was pretty good for the time, but it was dated. It didn't have a lot to it. There wasn't any depth. So I just began to update and began talking about this. And I've repeatedly found in my debates that I needed to refer to things. I needed to explain things. So I started writing about it. And that became the genesis, what became Semitic Controversies on Blogger. And then in 2017, I lost Semitic Controversies. It was deleted out of hand by Blogger. Happily, I have backups of everything. So so a couple of years later, after that, I relaunched it as a Substack, which is where I am now.
Gotcha. Fantastic. Flood and Scorpio, you guys are both gifted show hosts and questioners. Feel free to jump in. So let's go to Flood. Flood, do you have a topic you'd like to bring up with Carl or Dave?
I could bring up one from Twitter. Actually, a brilliant gentleman in Twitter has a request for Carl, and it may be best saved toward last. I'll let him decide that. But he would like Carl to weigh in, and I know that he's weighed in on this before, on the idea that that Hitler escaped Reich Germany to Argentina after the war. This is something that constantly resurfaces and goes around right-wing circles. I think it's a bit of a psyop, and I think Carl has kind of weighed in pretty definitively in the past on that one.
Would you like to jump on that one now, Carl, for a while, or save it for later?
I can weigh into that now. So the idea that Hitler escaped to Argentina in 1945 from Berlin is just a rerun of the Bormann conspiracy idea. In fact, it uses almost exactly the same evidence from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which was largely propounded by people like Ladislas Farago, who wrote a bunch of books about it, like Aftermath, among other things. So essentially, it doesn't make very much sense at all, because you know the plane he's allegedly went in was a one seater. It was an Arado, whatever it was. It's a one seater plane that you can barely fit a second person in, and Hitler wasn't a pilot. So we start this stuff, and then we have this idea that somehow he went to Argentina. Why did he go to Argentina? Argentina, okay, it was somewhat supportive, but there are much better countries you could have gone to, like, for example, Spain. I mean, Spain would be the obvious choice. It's got an ally. It's run by an ally. It's whatever. But the truth is, he died in Berlin, and there was a bit of mystery around his death because Heinz, whatever his name is, Lemke, I think, Linger, Heinz Linger, said basically that they burned his body after the suicide, and but then the area was hit by shell fire pretty soon after, which scattered his remains, and what is why there was always controversy around where they found his body, didn't find his body, where did his body go, etc. So it kind of just it's quite definitive in its way. But also, all the people in the bunker don't say anything of the kind. They don't say that he escaped. They don't mention it. They all seem to think he died. That's also in Soviet interviews as well. There's no indication whatsoever he survived, you know, let alone that he went to Argentina of all places.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, that one's got a lot of traction. There's a guy, the shark hunter, and he's been for decades been on Jeff Rentz, who has a millions of people audience for his shows at night. And so a lot of people believe that. And that's interesting to hear your academic take. Scorpio, would you like to bring up any topics or ask Carl anything?
I think it's personally about the Hitler issue. I think it's a little more ambiguous. There's a lot of strange things around that, I'm open to the possibility that it possibly did happen, but you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, honestly. I guess what, you know, the pressing issue today, especially for America, or actually the whole Western world, is that, you know, we've got this Jewish supremacism and Jewish parasitism on the back of Western civilization, and really actively working to destroy every aspect of it and transform it into something unrecognizable. And, you know, with Trump, we're seeing sort of this faux America First movement that's actually an Israeli First movement. And, but I do see a good thing in this is that people are going to expect something real very soon after this, because it's clear that this whole thing's going to be log jammed, and any good Trump may try to do or not do is going to be sabotaged all the way through. So I guess the question would be, really for the whole panel, is how do we build some kind of a political movement that is going to address the issue of Jewish power?
Let's start with Carl. That's a great question, Dave. That's just it. We don't have the military backing us, so we don't, until that miracle happens, we really can't have a 21st century charismatic leader like Hitler, because if you don't have might backing that, you can't make it right. So what are your thoughts on Dave's question, Carl?
So I'm approaching this from the perspective of being something of an accelerationist, in that I believe acceleration gets a bit of a bad name. So really what I'm saying is that when we look at this kind of situation in the US as it stands at the moment, the US, we have this problem whereby we're getting broken up into small bit groups and whatever. We have very little actual power. We have bits of localized power, bits of localized success, and some great success like that. However, I've always come back to two points. One is which is expressed by the French philosopher Louis Althusser. His wife was Jewish, but nevertheless, she sent him mad, and then he killed her, rather oddly. And then he said, what he said was basically, if the working class, the people, quote unquote, are going to change, they have to be at the point where there is huge amount of material problems. It's not a theoretical problem anymore. It's not a real. It's not something they can just ignore. It's actually affecting their daily lives. The other aspect of that is something that Savitri Devi, the NS philosopher stroke polymath, said rather well, in that where she expressed it, the concept of gold in the furnace, whereby what you have is you basically throw a load of metal into a load of people into a situation, and then the heat from the furnace, which is the pressure from the outside, burns off anyone who is too weak to deal with it, and essentially you get a situation where there comes a series of critical moments. So every so often there is what I would call a revolutionary moment where something changes. 9/11 is a good example of that. COVID was another example of it. Trump is actually weirdly another example of it, because he's created a series of revolutionary moments in and of himself, whereby what keeps happening is every time something changes, then we have an opportunity. Every time there's an opportunity, we make that bit much more progress, because we reach that much more people. Every time someone does a banner drop somewhere, someone else, we spread those seeds. It's that old analogy of no publicity is bad publicity, but also you have to spread seeds. You have to get people to look at things, you have to think about things. And it's that aspect of combination of networking, of having solid arguments, having your arguments fit reality, which is a big one to me. And also, I think it's fundamentally about people as we go forward. There's groups come into existence, and then they die because of outside pressure. This is the Savitri Devi thing. They then roll through these series of failures, and we get stronger and stronger and stronger as we go forward. You can kind of see it. What's happening now is that if you guys remember back to like the 90s or the 80s, our kind of groups were really weak, and we weren't very good at what we were doing. But over time, what's happened is we've become really, really good at fighting the information war from a position of weakness. But we've also become really, really good at networking and finding ways around problems that have been presented to us, which is partly how our race works. We are, as a people, very creative. It's the advantage that Europeans have always had. We're very creative people. We don't have the quote unquote high IQ of the sort of Han Chinese, but we are so good at creating solutions to problems that's essentially what we're doing. We're going through all these iterations really, 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 really fast to find solutions to existential problems. And that's what happened historically in Germany in the 1880s to the 1933. They went through lots and lots of these groups. Lots and lots of these groups failed, but in a slower way to us. And then all of a sudden, you get to 1933. And this is what people don't see. It's that classic band and entrepreneurship analogy of people want to know, how do I become the next Hitler? How do I become the next lead singer of a mainstream of a big band? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to play to lots of audiences or no audiences at all in dive bars and whatever. So you have lots of speeches to people who you don't like, but in so doing, you produce a cumulative effect. And it's that cumulative effect that is really coming in with shows like yours, Floods, we've got X, we've got all these different groups then now that are existing, and they're actually cooperating to some degree, which is great to see. So it's that nice snowball effect. So I'm pretty optimistic about the future of Mars. Yes, it's going to be hard. Yes, people are going to go to prison. People are going to die. But this is the nature of what struggle is. And this is why I'm a socialist, because struggle is at the heart of everything that we do and everything, how we exist as people and human beings.
Oh, that's really inspirational. Flood, your thoughts.
Man, how do you follow this guy? I can really only I mostly agree. I think to Mein Kampf, and I think that, Hitler very much spelled out that what had to occur was a lot like what Carl said. People's daily bread had to be threatened. There had to be real world ramifications to the evil that was happening in people's lives. And then there will be a ground up spiritual movement that will start to flow through the people. And this will take the place of, or this will take the form of essentially dissidents at first. And then eventually a movement will kind of be born from this. And when you look at some of the old footage, when you see all the Reich footage and you see the men marching through the streets with guns, and you see all the brown shirts are just marching up and down all the roads. Those were political rallies. You know what I mean? Those men with guns were marching in political rallies for the political party, and that was a very fast rolling political movement that happened in Germany that kind of climaxed in 1933 when they took power. I think we are seeing the same thing happen. I think we are seeing a diversity of tactics that are gathered around a common set of goals, and that is how these things begin. And what it turns into from here is probably anybody's guess, but it will probably echo the same things that happened then.
Can I do a follow-up here?
Of course. Sure.
Go ahead. I honestly don't think that whatever's going to happen in the United States, it's not going to be based around any model of Germany, Nazi Germany in 1933. America's a totally different country, and we're in a completely different place in terms of not only history, but the makeup of the country and the mindset of the country. I'm pretty confident whatever's going to happen is not going to resemble Nazi Germany. Like it or not, that's just my perception of things. Given that we're in America, I think the American Civil War might be a better understanding of, or a starting point of, a possible change, because if one state decides that it doesn't want to be under the thumb of the federal government at some point, then you could have a spark that could be lit. But honestly, I don't see how we're going to have another Hitler type character come in and change America. I just don't think that's realistic. I know that's not a popular view, but that's just kind of where I am with things.
Well, Dave, do you think, and then I'd like to get Carl's thoughts on what your observation is. Do you think that the key difference is Germany was a homogeneous society and it was all German, and so when they all suffered together and they all had the history, the long, thousand-year history of German roots, whereas here, I mean, the Jew has done such a sad but effective job of flooding this country. I mean, when I was a little boy growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Milwaukee was 97% white. The state of Wisconsin was 93% white. The country was 92 to 94. 4% white. And in my lifetime, I've seen this invasion, especially since the passing of the traitorous Hart-Sellers Act. And so do you think that's the key differentiator, Dave, that we just don't have enough humans who share and remember what this country was? You know, you need to be like 55 years or older to remember America as a white high trust society.
Well, that's certainly a valid point. I agree. And the other thing is, you know, this kind of goes back to the tariff issue. Look at how Americans have been reduced to this consumerism society. We don't have any kind of nationalistic thinking. Most people don't. All they care about is, well, how much can I buy the new Xbox for? Or how much is my iPhone going to cost? So the biggest issue at hand is stopping immigration. And the focus has been on illegal immigration, but no one's talking about legal immigration. Like, that has to stop.
Right.
And it's almost all from these, you know, bizarre countries that have nothing to do with Western civilization or the roots of America. And that has to be stopped. And going back to my question, like, I know it's popular in white national circles to talk about, well, we're going to wait for a collapse. Let's have an acceleration. Then once we have the collapse, then we can get what we want. But personally, I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think it's realistic. So the only alternative, if that is correct assumption, is we have to build some kind of political movement that addresses the outrageous Jewish power. Because I don't want to talk about anti-Semitism. That's a mask for Jewish power. That's a way to skirt around the issue of Jewish power. Oh, anti-Semitism, no, Jewish power. We got these people who really think very foreign in terms of most Americans, most Westerners. Their ideas and their values are very odd and not in touch with most people. But it's infected our society to such a horrible degree that we do not resemble in any way Nazi Germany or the Weimar Republic, as bad as that was, we don't resemble it at all.
Well, Carl, and then Flood, I'm sure you guys have some thoughts on Dave's contrarian position. Carl, your thoughts?
It's understandable. It's an old, if I might say, Dave says, Dave, it's an old objection. I've heard this many, many years, for many, many years. First of all, one of the assumptions that you make is that the Third Reich had to look exactly how it looked. In part, that was because the Germans, because you had a Hitler figure, but in also part because that's actually in some respects the natural form of society. If you think about someone like Bukele in wherever it is, I can't remember the actual country at the moment. That's kind of how it devolves to. But in America, America has its own interesting little weird history of basically having ersatz dictatorships without having dictatorships. And all Germany did was basically change that into one person. It's a bit like, and the reason I would come back to Germany being actually not as bad an example as people often think it is, it's because Germany, contrary to perceived wisdom, was actually at the time very federal. So there you had in Germany you had lots of different states. They all had different laws. They all had different parliaments. They all had different legislatures. They all had different all sorts of different things to do with. They often had even entirely different police forces, different systems, and you had one overarching entity, which was the Reich government, kind of similar to the US. So in essence, that was taken and changed. So Hitler actually changed that to be what it was. So what you were actually describing is a Weimar Germany. It's just a Weimar Germany that people don't like to talk about because it breaks in, makes the analogy more to America than not. But you are right in the sense that the US has its own unique history, has its own unique ties, its own unique situation. And National Socialism actually says, yes, that is true, because there is no one form of National Socialism. If you go back to the National Socialist writers of the time, they were talking in different terms. Goebbels was quite keen on guild socialism. Rosenberg was quite keen on having a parliament, what he called kind of a racial senate. And you had other people who had different ideas all the different time about it. And it just kind of mashed together, and whatever worked was what they went with. And it's kind of a it's less a formal system. It's more of a system of what actually works for a given situation. It's that kind of evolution by struggle concept that it's quite a concept. But also, I think saying that the one person won't come and rise and change everything, I think Trump disproves that. I think Trump, if it shows that America wants a strong man, America is quite keen on a strong man, just as long as the strong man doesn't say he is the dictator. Kind of like Rome and Julius Caesar and Octavian. They didn't call themselves emperor. They just said, I'm the first among equals. But forgive the slight Animal Farm reference. But that's, in essence, what's going on and kind of how it thinks. And yes, I do think it's going to refer to a lot to the Confederacy, to the Union, to really that 1860s to 1920s era nationalism that was very common in the US, that we have, that where there was a lot of it was opposition to free trade, you had a national protectionist economy, it was thriving, and so on and so forth. I think the American future will be national socialist, but it won't call itself national socialism, if you want me to be blunt about it, in the same way that Syria adopted Baathism, and Baathism is essentially national socialism until Assad fell, is their version of it. So I think that's maybe where we're getting to. But also on the accelerationism point, accelerationism doesn't predict that everything's going to collapse. That's a common misnomer. And it's also something that some people who claim to be accelerationists kind of claimed. However, when we talk about economic collapses, they're very, very, very rare. I mean, to the point where there's only really one that's ever happened in recentish history, which is in Russia in 1917, caused by the failure by basically Turkey entering World War One, which cut off Russia's economy from the West to a large degree, and then basically the war itself contributed to a system where the system actually collapsed. Didn't truly collapse, but came very, very, very close. And there was a lot of issues there. Whereas if you look back in like Germany, in the UK, in Spain, in the US, they've never really collapsed economically. They've had problem times. They've had really bad times, but they've never really collapsed in that same way, which is why I always warn people, don't think about the system is going to collapse, because I've been reading people from the 70s and 80s and 90s and 2000s who all thought it was going to collapse at their particular point in time. And it never does. It never does, because the system is organic. It will always find a way. They'll always find a way forward. It's just what that way forward is, you don't necessarily know. So that's what I'd say, is that we're not fighting for to go forward in terms of saying, okay, the system is going to collapse, we'll take power when it collapses. What we're saying is go forward and fight and spread the word, get your house in order, as Peterson would say, clean your room, so to speak, and both in your personal and your professional and your family life, and spread the word, live the values, continue your political education, spread, and, you know, become what Christians like to call living stones, become beacons of your faith, so to speak, your political faith in this case. And then at a moment in history, at some point in the future, I don't know when, I can't predict when, but there will come a time when that revolutionary moment will come, and we will be in a strong enough position to be partly contending with it. It's the same way that AfD has become to contend in Germany, the same way that LFN is contending in France. They started out from nothing. They had to grow, and it's that hard slog based upon that knowledge of you want that revolutionary moment of change. That's the hard bit. That's the hard bit of accelerationism. It's not all fall down. It's not okay, it's all going to fall down and we'll take power. It's more, we're building to the slog, and then there'll be a moment. We take that moment and we move forward. If you want a historical example, I'll use Germany again, but you probably don't know that in 1932, basically the Germans were dealing with a situation where the NSDAP was falling apart. It almost did fall apart multiple times throughout late 1932, early 1933, and even days before Hitler assumes power in January 33, you've got SA leaders who were rebelling against Hitler, saying, "I'm gonna take all my people off." They were denouncing him, saying he was wrong. So And then, of course, you have Hitler assumes the chancellorship, and then all of a sudden they're all proved wrong, which is kind of the analogy I'm getting to here, that there's a lot of people who will always say, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, until you're right. And the same is true of Lenin, because remember, Lenin was highly depressed in 1916.
I'm sorry. And then, pardon me.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. And then, so Lenin was incredibly depressed in 1916. He thought the revolution was never going to happen. Next year, revolution happens. Hitler, he's highly depressed in 24, he was going to kill himself. And then, was it 9 years later, he's Chancellor of Germany. These things are never quite as cut and dried as they would appear. And often opportunity presents itself out of the worst times. And I think that's going to be the case with us. Sorry, it's a bit long, but
no, excellent. Flood, you want to weigh in? Any thoughts?
Sure. I don't really think that Dave's position was really contrarian. I actually tend to agree with him on a lot of his points. My ultimate point is it's very difficult to predict how this movement will manifest. How this Hitler clearly described this upwelling Aryan spirit, really, is what he's talking about. And there is an ongoing struggle between the Aryan spirit and this Jewish, kind of evil thing that's going on. And mm-hmm. this has come to a head. There's a well-established pattern. About 109 times this has happened. And what eventually happens, however it manifests, is that the people have had enough at a certain point in time. And if we're talking about political power, we're not necessarily talking about a group of people that have gotten AIPAC's consent to go in and play in Congress. But basically, we're talking about a bunch of really pissed off people that have had enough. And we're getting there. And however that manifests will probably be different than what we saw in Germany or what we saw in the Civil War. But the same thing is happening. And that is that people are taking power back away from the people who have stolen it or who have, wrongfully accumulated it. And that is the repeating cycle that's occurring over and over and over, and should be a little bit different. Will another Hitler arise? I think that's a possibility. We don't really see anything on the horizon as far as that goes. But I also agree with Carl. Those things tend to happen out of nowhere, out of the blue. So I don't rule anything out. And you do kind of have to be ready for anything. But the biggest thing is like to listen to this calling, right? Because a lot of us are hearing it. We wouldn't be having this show if this wasn't happening, because we would have been well censored and none of us would have been brave enough to talk about these things. But this is a mounting pressure from within us that is going to manifest eventually.
Oh, excellent points. Really enjoying this discussion. Hopefully, Carl and Flood, you'll be willing to come back and do this again next month and every month. This is really compelling. Good news, FTJ Media is back up. There we are there, so that's cool to see. Glad the upgrade didn't take as long. Welcome, everybody, over at FTJ. And my next question, Carl, is it seems to me, Professor Norman Finkelstein of the University of Illinois, a PhD peer of yours, as far as a man of letters, is wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry, and really laid out that the linchpin since probably the early 70s has been this Mu-Holocaust, as the meme, M-U-H, Mu-Holocaust. And anyone with an IQ, in my opinion, above 85 can spend 30 minutes on the internet and you can see the math just doesn't add up, right? I mean, I've done many shows where had a guest who worked at a pet crematorium, and he points out that it takes 30 minutes to an hour to cremate, a 40 or 50 pound dog. So how did these 100, 150 pound prisoners, so-called, get cremated so quick? And yada, yada, yada. Everybody knows that the Holocaust is an incredibly effective psyop lie, and yet we now have in the United States, I think it's up to 21 states who are at the state level have passed laws dictating Holocaust education. The vile kike Deborah Lipstadt was recently appointed by the corrupt and traitorous Biden administration as a Holocaust. I don't even know what her title was, but she was essentially, you know, make sure the U.S. government continues to promulgate the lies of the Holocaust. And so how do you see this playing out? Because more and more, especially young people, are the Holocaust is bullshit. You know, we can all do the math. We've been gamers for so long. Our frontal lobes are almost mutated. We can think quickly and see through certain things quickly. And it doesn't have much time left, and yet they're pushing it, man. They're pushing it. Holocaust, 6 million died. Oh, the Shoah. And how do you see this playing out, Carl? As when will it actually finally and justifiably collapse? And the blowback on the international Jew should be substantial, in my opinion.
Well, I don't know how it's going to collapse per se, but it's very much at the point it's just collapsing under its own weight. In that, you're probably not aware, but Majdanek, one of the camps, has now basically been the general consensus, as my friend Dr. Otto Paul was telling me on Twitter, is that it wasn't an extermination camp, but yet allegedly it was, according to mainstream historians, until very, very recently. And the point is that we're getting to this juncture where people, I've asked questions about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is not an intuitive theory at all. The as you say, the more you ask questions about the Holocaust, the more ridiculous it becomes. The more you know about it, the more scorn you have a tendency to pour on it. Because there's all sorts of these, if I may say, batshit claims that out there. I think I quoted the other one the other day, which is the claim by the U.S. Justice Jackson during the Nuremberg trial, that he was arguing with Albert Speer that the Germans tested an atomic bomb on 20,000 Jews near Auschwitz in Poland and basically evaporated them. But again, that doesn't make it into the claims, unsurprisingly. But is it going to fall apart? Yes. When? I don't know, but it's quite clear that there's been this tension in the Holocaust field itself for quite a long time between groups. You see, in the 80s, you had two groups called the Intentionalists and Functionalists. The Intentionalists were people like Lucy Davidovits, who argued that there was a Hitler order and we just hadn't found it yet. And the Functionalists were people who said there was no Hitler order, it just magically happened. Or it just happened via some German progression of policy. So essentially that ended with basically the functionalists winning, because they've never found a Hitler order. The general consensus now is there never was one. And it just happened basically by magic. And now you have a situation where you've got a lot of Holocaustians are trying to shift the Holocaust away from the camps and the gas chambers into the east, into the Einsatzgruppen. So they want to shift the Holocaust to what they call the Holocaust by bullets, basically moving it from a completely implausible, ridiculous theory with lots of weird stuff in it to a plausible theory where they can at least do some kind of argument that is not reliant on some really dodgy sources. But I think what will inevitably kill the Holocaust as a theory and as a concept will be exposing it to ridicule. I think the more we ridicule the Holocaust, the harder it is for them to maintain it. Because, I mean, how many times can you ask someone, oh, by the way, have you seen this this particular claim, you know, from that is, like, for example, one where which comes from one of the Eichmann witnesses. So the witnesses at the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem in 1961, where he claims that, I think it was at Auschwitz, that basically another Jew had a jar of marmalade appended over him, and all the other Jews, including him, ate him alive. So, you know, it's all this stuff that just turns up, and you just go, what on earth? And there's only so much of that you can deal with before you start going, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm going to have to investigate this. And you end up in the situation of investigating it and you don't believe it. And the more the youth do that, which they're doing, you're right, I was a gamer too. So they're all, so people So people who investigate, they're looking at it. They are realizing it's bollocks. They are no longer being bullied by the Holocaust industry. The Holocaust industry's response is very typically Jewish, which is kind of back to what I was saying earlier about Jews repeat the same tactics again and again and again and again. They don't really innovate that much in terms of their tactics, which is, if we go back to the history, they just bully. All they were doing in the 20s and 30s is they were bullying people, trying to ban everyone. They didn't answer objections. They tried to bully their way through it. Rather famously, the head of police of Berlin was Jewish, and he had a long-running spat with Goebbels. And so Goebbels produced a cartoon in Der Angriff about him, basically with him looking like a donkey. So Weiss then has Goebbels taken to court. He wins the court case that this is a bad slander of thing, and Goebbels has to apologize in his newspaper. What Goebbels does is he republishes the cartoon with the caption, "The Berlin court agrees that this cartoon looks like Herr Dr. Weiss." So, and of course, this drove everyone completely nuts because Goebbels was running rings around them. But that's how you do it. You make people laugh. You poke fun at it. And that causes people to seriously think about the argument. The same is true of the radical left. A lot of the radical left and the anti-Zionist left, you'll find that a lot of them are quite receptive to anti-Holocaust arguments because they're so used to it being thrown at them. There's been quite a few of them over the years who've trickled over to our side of the fence because they've realized, well, the Holocaust isn't real because they've gone and investigated it because the Jews use it so much. And then you have, as you rightly said, the Holocaust industry. And even then, Finkelstein's only touching the surface of the kind of stuff that went on and still goes on. And if you bother to look at the claims conference website and various different things, you'll see that they're still claiming other things. They, in fact, they've made repeated claims against the United States for money. Not just everyone else. They've done it to firms. They've done it to countries. They've done it to everything I can think of, to individuals, to banks, you name it. They've done it.
Right.
And that's running out. And when is that going to run out? I don't know. But my best guess is we're going to see that the Holocaust is going to become mandated orthodoxy, and then it will fail. The more it becomes enforced orthodoxy, the more it's going to fail, the harder it's going to be. And eventually you will find Jews saying, we didn't do that. You're completely exaggerating that. And that's when you know you've won.
Oh, fantastic. Flood, I know you have thoughts on this, and then we'll go to Dave Scorpio after. Go ahead, Flood.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad that you cited Finkelstein or that you've singled him out. I audiobooked the Holocaust industry.
Awesome.
And I kind of felt it as a bit of a capitulation, kind of the Jew running out front, right? Doing damage control, pointing out the damage that Jews are doing by overusing the Holocaust. I feel like this was a win for our side whenever he wrote that, because essentially that's what they do, right? There's always a Jew that kind of signals the impending collapse of this narrative. And I think Finkelstein was one such Jew. I do believe 100% in what Carl just said, that simply by the ridiculousness of it and pointing out the fact that this one thing has gotten more people fired in the last 5 years, more people have probably lost their jobs because they disagreed with a historical narrative from 80 years ago. And that was reason and grounds enough to fire people, to remove their tenure, to debank and destroy people. Why are people continually being ruined because they have questions about this certain thing that happened 80 years ago, and all of the other things that they could question or be critical of don't bring them anywhere near that kind of trouble. This is an obvious, a very obvious problem and a very obvious mismatch in the amount of attention that it gets and the amount of penalty that it carries to ask this question, right? It's just ridiculous that a 95-year-old woman can go to prison for simply having a disagreeing with the narrative on the Holocaust. But yet we see this as this is illegal in at least, I think, 17 countries in Europe, that you can't question the Holocaust. That itself will be enough to as younger and younger people become aware of this bullshit, they just aren't buying it. They're just not buying it. And the cookie analogies are great. I love the how many cookies can you bake in X number of hours, et cetera, et cetera. it's being thrown out there in so many ways, and it is very much culturally challenged. The memes, they can't keep up with the memes. They can't keep up with the questions. They can't keep up with Twitter. Even Twitter, they would rather just shut Twitter down than own up to or even debate the idea on even ground. So I think that their own behavior is going to ruin them on this, and all we have to do is continue to crack jokes and make memes about it.
Great point. Dave Scorpio, your thoughts on the hopefully sooner than later collapse of the brutal Holocaust lie that's cost so many in terms of money, in terms of, like Flood just pointed out, career, for questioning what is just a ridiculous lie. Your thoughts, Dave?
Well, you know, I've said for some time that the Holocaust has reached its expiration date. And really, I think the only thing that's keeping it alive are the older generations. Most of the younger people know it's a lie and or don't care. Because one thing that certainly has happened is that the Jews, have proven themselves or shown themselves, exposed themselves to being the victimizers. They're not the victims of anything. They are the victimizers. And, you know, the recent events in Gaza has illustrated that to the entire world in a very gory, dark way. And there's no way, no matter how much counter propaganda they try, to erase that. And, you know, some people say, well, who cares what they do to the Palestinians? I get that. But look, they'll do it to anybody. They're just doing it to the Palestinians right now. We don't know who their next target might be. It'd probably be somewhere in the West, actually, because the Jews by nature are parasites and they don't really care what they feed on and what they throw away after the bones are picked dry. So I think it's a generational thing. Its days are numbered, and I don't think there's any stopping it. It's already too late. It's really only being kept alive on television and the mainstream media, but anywhere out there in the real world, most people already know, especially the younger generation. So it's kind of over, and look what they're doing. You know, this is kind of another interesting discussion is, you know, the left is much more aware of, or right now, much more anti-Zionist, that's what they call it, which is not that far away from being anti-Jew. It's just a starting point. Whereas the right, the kosher conservatives, are completely, wound up in this ridiculous notion that the Jews are the chosen people and that Israel's our greatest ally. And that's largely due to religion being fed this, false narrative about the Jews being God's chosen people. So the left is already on to this, and I think that's unexpected. I do not believe that the Jews thought that the left would turn on them so hard as they have. And right now we've got a lot of young people that are protesting what's going on in Gaza, and they're getting the full wrath and facing the full force of Jewish power. And the catch-22 for the Jew is the more they push back, the more their power becomes self-evident. And that's a real problem for them, because one of the reasons that Jewish power has worked so well in the past is that it's been covert, and that's no longer the case.
Oh, that's a great point. That leads me to my next question we'll go in the same order again, Carl, Flood, and then Dave Scorpio, is in the last 5 years, we've witnessed three massive subversive attacks on the First World in pursuit of the international Jew wet dream of one world government, one world religion. The first was the COVID scamdemic with releasing gain of function bioweapons and calling it and driving people, emergency orders to, you got to go get this Jew jab, this vaccine, even though it was not a vaccine. It was illegal and immoral and basically untested gene therapy. And so many people did, and they're dropping from terrible cancers from the bizarre a growth of fibrin and plaque-like things in their arteries. It's stunning how many they've injured and murdered in pursuit of that. Another thing we didn't even bring up yet is the singularity, where the Jew really wants technology to merge with nature and humanity. So their dark entity that they worship, be it Moloch or Baal, B-A-apostrophe-A-L, or Baphomet, whatever, can somehow enter this reality via artificial intelligence. And it's just so bizarre, and hopefully will fail miserably. So they did that. Then before that, actually, the color revolution began in the Ukraine in 2014 with a vile, traitorous Victoria Nudelman Kagan driving that bus. And that is has been just a meat grinder, and it's tragic for the young, both male and female Ukrainians who have just been slaughtered by the superior Russian forces. And now the third one is the Gaza, the justification worldwide to even though, as a Johns Hopkins study recently proved, 97% of all Israelis who claim to have a genetic tie to Palestine have no such thing. They're basically, you know, Eastern Europeans and Germans and Russians and what have you. They have no actual claim from blood to that soil. And so, but what they've done is, as Scorpio so astutely mentioned moments ago, they have taken their victimhood, which, you know, it's sad, one of the major weaknesses that the Jew preys upon is the empathy and the sympathy and the compassion of whites, and who are so naive to think that positive emotion should be saved for other whites in a high trust white society. You cannot offer the same what is weakness in reality to the Jew or to sub-Saharans or to Muslims or to the many different Browns that are currently invading all the first world countries. And so, Carl, the question is that all three have basically failed, especially Gaza. If the Jew didn't control the mainstream media in the first world countries, the real media would be covering this and saying, my God, this is a genocide. This is a slaughter. Look at how many people worldwide now hate the Jew, which is, in my mind, a very positive thing. And so, but it's being suppressed because the Jew controls these mass media outlets. And my question is, three times they've like that old ESPN poker analogy, late night poker shows, going all in. They went in all in three times. And all three have basically failed, in my opinion. And your thoughts, you know, which one of these all-ins is going to finally just really, really explode back on them and do some real damage?
To me, the one that's really, really screwed them over is Gaza. Because, first of all, the reason they went after Gaza was because they want the oil. There's a massive oil field off Gaza that people don't often know about. That's basically the way they're going to, they want to run, basically fund their economy. Because it's often not known that the Israeli economy is incredibly parasitic. It's basically a complete basket case without the US funding huge amounts of money into it year upon year. But the reason I say it's Gaza and not the others is because Gaza showed them for the people that I and people like me have known they are for a long time, based upon their history, because this is what they would do in history. They do horrific stuff historically. They'll roast people over fires. They'll decorate themselves with entrails, according to Cassius Dio in the 100s in Rome and Egypt and co. And you've got them in 1945. They are engaging in several attempts of mass genocide. They're poisoning wells. They're doing all this stuff. And you've got other times when they're quite happily, you know, they're quite happy. They'll starve whole villages to death because of loans and that kind of thing. So what people saw is the image that Jews have represented they've over the years is they've created this idea that they are a innocent people, that they didn't do anything wrong, that anti-Semites have got them wrong, their opponents have just lied about them. You know, they have, you know, they're just a great misunderstood people who have contributed so much to humanity. And then literally above, in front of people's eyes, they've switched from this perspective to being basically exterminate them all, burn them all, kill them all. We did Dresden. You know, nuking the Europeans isn't a bad thing. And people just wonder. People just look at it, and there's absolute horror. Like, who are these people? Yeah. These are the Jews. These are the people that I guess I've known for years and years and years now. And this is who they really are. This is why I tell people that the best way to understand them and why they do what they do is to think of them like a people who are a collective, who are like psychopaths. They are all very short term. They're very manipulative. They've got massive egos, which, by the way, you'll see if you ever, when you debate Jews, you watch what happens when you insult a Jew's ego. It's hilarious. But then they have this habit of they get a certain amount of success, they do well, and then it all falls apart because they go too far, they do too much, they take their mask off, and they do something. Whether that something is something, you know, whether it be, you know, they're starving people to death in the Ukraine twice, I might add, or they are, you know, killing people in Germany, or they are in America, they've collapsed stuff in America, they're killing people in Gaza, they're murdering Christians in Yemen. It's whatever moment it is, that's when the anti-Semitism, as we might call it, triggers, and we get the rising against the Jews. This is when Jews immediately start saying, oh, we didn't do anything, it wasn't our fault, you know, woe is me. And a great book I always tell people to read on this is actually written by a Jew, a libertarian Jew, actually. It was called The Fatal Embrace, Jews and the State by Benjamin Ginsberg in 1993, because it kind of talks about this to some degree, where he kind of says, well, this is what keeps happening, is that Jews keep coming this middle class, and then stuff happens, and they keep dominating things, like, for example, the Ottoman customs service was so Jewish that it that their official language, I think, was Hebrew, that effectively you keep getting this response and Jews don't learn. So, and because bits of the elite then turn on them, then the people hate them so much, and then you have this combination of the two things. To get back to how the revolutions happen, you get this combination of a small part of the elite with the mass of the people, and bang, that's usually when you get your pogroms, you get your riots, you get your mass murders, you get your, you know, lining Jews up against the wall, you get the Kimmel-Nicky revolts, if you've ever heard of them, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. That's what's going to happen. And to me, it's their own fault. They pushed it too far, and then they just started publicly on live television screaming to exterminate everyone else, and then playing the victim. So, I mean, what do they expect?
That's a great point. Flood, I know you have some thoughts.
Oh, always. I have to agree, like, completely with Dave and with Carl. Dave hit it just directly on the head that they're used to operating behind the curtain, and they have let the mask slip. And, of course, in their bloodlust, they have gone on a bit of a frenzy. And then you have guys like Rabbi Shmuley, who you had in your intro, you know, screaming about babies and lampshades. It all just adds to the ridiculousness of this stuff. And the snowball is rolling down the hill. You know, they're not hiding. They're not able to contain their dark ecstasy of all the dead kids that we get to see on Twitter and on television. And it is a shame that I think it is Gaza that is going to bring all of the attention, all of the things that we want to happen, or all of the accelerationists are sort of waiting for. I believe Gaza is going to be the catalyst that sets that off. I think that they do have huge designs on the Gaza Strip. There is oil out there. They do want to build another Suez Canal, you know, where they want to essentially take away, you know, Egypt's grip on, you know, that part of the world and trade. Right. And, you know, they have big, big designs that lead to big, big profit. Donald Trump's clearly a part of this. This is just all out in the open. And while most of the, I think, the Trump right are in this kind of stupor, where they can't quite, you know, figure out that the demons that are controlling everything are the very Jews that they're trying to protect all the time. They're very close to that, those two things snapping together. But I've always kind of put forth this idea that what would happen if, you know, and how much would it shock everybody if it was actually the left that initiated, you know, the next pogroms, the next Holocaust, the, you know, like we've all kind of just been quietly waiting and looking at each other here on the right and just being quiet. But the left is turning on them. Their golems are turning on them. And I don't think they can reverse this trend.
Great point, Scorpio. I know you have thoughts. And then if you would like to bring up or ask Carl or Flood a question, please do so after your thoughts.
Well, Flood brought up some great points. And, you know, what's happening in Gaza, what makes it kind of unique is that everybody has a cell phone now. So, you know, all of this horrific footage has been put up on, you know, especially TikTok. We all know that's the reason why TikTok has been attacked, not because it's an asset of China. It's because of all the viral footage that's gone around about the horrific war crimes surrounding Gaza. And, of course, the latest is, you know, they murdered, you know, 15 rescue workers and actually buried two ambulances in a mass grave. I mean, what more of a war crime could you possibly have when you murder
right.
people who are driving an ambulance with the lights on? You know, I mean, this is so outrageous. And, you know, I think Flood brought up another important point. I wanted to kind of bring this into the forefront because, you know, Tom Metzger always said toward the end of his life, especially, that, you know, look to the left. For recruits in this matter, not the right. The right's too uptight. They're trying to hold on to old ideas that really don't matter anymore. And, you know, the left is much more aware of the Jewish problem than the right now. And I think that caught everybody by surprise. And it's because their own golem has gone out of control. This golem of we love everybody and, you know, equal rights for everybody. And well, wait a minute, you guys are slaughtering an entire, you know, group of people here and trying to take their land from them, which, you know, in all honesty, that's just a horrible thing to do to anybody. And so I think my question would be is, given that the left, you know, is really I want everyone to answer this if they could, given that the left is really kind of much more aware of the Jewish problem than the right overall. You know, I've been talking to this guy at the gym that's a communist, which is kind of interesting, and he's well aware of the Jewish problem. I don't think he's aware that Jews created communism, but I haven't laid that one on him yet. But so my question would be, is, do any of you guys think there's a way to unite or form an alliance, at least, between the left and the right? Because that's one of the ways that they've kept everyone, you know, divided up with these wedge issues like the tranny thing and, you know, homos and all this stuff that really, you know, I think it's a lot of the tranny stuff's been blown out of proportion. It's more on TV than in real life.
Right.
And I just don't think that many people are actually doing it. But so how do we form an alliance between the left and the right, or is that even possible? I mean, because I think right now the right is just ridiculous in this country. It's kosher conservatism all the way. And, you know, so what do you guys think? Is there a way to form an alliance between the left and the right?
Let's go Carl, Flood, and then I'll jump in. Carl dropped off momentarily, perhaps a technical issue, but Scorpio was bringing up the point that really the left is more Jew wake now, even though they call themselves woke and they're not, see the evil of the international Jew far more than the MAGA-tard right. And so Dave is wondering, if things get bad enough, do you see the possibility of an alliance to take on the international Jew between the far right and the far left, Carl?
I think this is kind of interesting because this is always something that it comes up a lot with people, is that I think a lot of people say that, you know, the left, they say that it comes to the left and the right as being more apart than we actually are. The far left have a lot of agreement with us. And historically, we've often recruited from the far left. We haven't actually often recruited from the conservatives. We've recruited bits from the conservatives. A lot of the people come from, a lot of people from the right, from the far right, often come from the far left or the left because of the kind of just how the kind of radicalization and conveyor works. Are we going to ally with the left? Bits of the left, sure, I think we all ally with. I think there's always a thing with the left that you have to be aware of. They have their own de-radicalization crowd. You have a lot of Jews who like to say, oh, it's not the Jews, it's Zionists, or, you know, something along those lines. And I think he's completely right to say, are we going to ally with them? Yes, probably. But it's whoever is in the dominant position. If we're allying with the left, we want to be in the dominant position, because if we're in the inferior position, we're going to get forced to do what the left wants more than the left is forced to do what we want. So that's what I think. That's where I think we need to go with this, is we keep red pilling the left. We red pill the right, red pill the left. Yes, I don't think we're going to have a lot of success with MAGATARDs, but we have to keep pushing that angle as well, because they are in some respects partly our natural constituency. But also, as Trump fails, as Trump gets betrayed by the Jews repeatedly, because we know from last time that Jared Kushner basically ran the White House,
right,
and did things that were ridiculous and were anti-American, it gets harder and harder for the MAGATARDs to engage in cognitive dissonance. So we need to be able to welcome them when they eventually have that moment of being like, I can't do this anymore. And conversely, we need to be able to welcome the left and say, look, your leftist positions, your thoughts, you know, your opposition to capitalism, your opposition to all these things, great, you know, but identify the root cause of that, and then we bring them in that way. I think we have to focus on viewing them as recruitment, areas for recruitment, areas for expansion for ourselves, rather than saying, oh, we're going to ally with them, then we'll succeed. I think we need to be much firmer around, we don't need allies to succeed, we need recruits to succeed. And that comes with making sure that all our propaganda, all our talking points fit different criteria. So people do different things in different ways, and it goes to different audiences, you know, marketing, sales tactics and theory. So essentially, we are going to have a lot of leftists come into our movement. We're going to have a lot. We're going to have some more rightists come into our movement, and we're going to be able, and we have to move them to kind of together to form kind of a new man, a new way, whatever you want to call it. And that's going to be, that to me is what is going to happen. But yes, for the meantime, we're ganging up with leftists on Twitter and places against the Jews, against the Zionists. But we've got to use those as opportunities to recruit and to red pill the leftists, if you want to understand me. That's kind of where I'd go with it.
Oh, excellent. Flood, I know you have some thoughts.
Most definitely. I'm going to agree by disagreeing, just in that I think Carl's right. I think it's a brilliant question, by the way, Dave. You know, can we ally with the left? Can we find some common ground to work together? I don't believe so. But what I do know that we can do is that we can catalyze the left, right? And I'm not talking really about the middle, the conservative right. I'm talking about the radical right. Not only do we have the ability, but we have the duty to drive those two forces together. And even if the left won't agree with us, if we can't agree on anything, we can manipulate the shit out of them. And we're very good at this. And we can trigger them into attacking their masters. That's something that's totally within our ability. And it wouldn't necessarily be an alliance, but there would be a working together in that regard, that we would be using the left to our designs. I think that's possible.
Wow, that's really a good point. Flood, are there any topics? We're coming up to the final 24 minutes of the show. The great show's just raced by. And again, this has been an honor to have three impressive thinkers, Carl, Scorpio, and Flood, all join the show. It's really an honor. Flood, is there anything that you would topics you'd like to bring up that haven't been brought up thus far?
You know, there's not. I would just say that it's really a pleasure to sit down and talk with guys. I rarely get a chance to sit down and have like these kind of discussions. It's always a pleasure to talk with Carl, to talk with yourself, and to talk with Scorpio. And I'm so not up with what's happening today, and I'm about 2 weeks behind on the news cycle that I wouldn't risk embarrassing myself by trying to bring up anything or ask anything.
Can I follow up on what?
Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought both of you guys had a great response, and I think Flood, I think your assessment is probably very realistic that it's really not possible to have a true alliance, but perhaps temporary coalition towards similar goals, and then once those goals are met, then the alliance is off. But there is a blurring, you know, Carl brought a great point, and I've thought this for years, that there is a blurring between the far left and the far right. There comes a point where they actually converge. And you can make the argument that Hitler came from the left as much as he came from the right. And in America, you've had, you know, the populist movement that overlapped with some of the pro-union, pro-workers, pro-American workers thinking. There's some serious overlap those old movements. And the America First movements, keeping America out of World War II, there was quite a bit of overlap between the left and the right at that point, because anti-war sentiment was really quite prominent on both sides of the political aisle. It wasn't until we were manipulated with the deliberate psyop of Pearl Harbor that American opinion began to change. It was something like 80% of Americans were against joining World War II, because the memories of World War I were still fresh in the American mind. And so I think there is some overlap there. And it's just interesting that when the two things converge, if you go far enough left and far enough right, there is some kind of convergence. And we need to find a way to capitalize on that.
Carl, your thoughts, and then Flood.
I would agree that, I mean, in the sense that the sort of the right left theory isn't very good political theory. It hasn't been for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
But it's because a lot of the right is traditionally anti-capitalist. It's basically pro-business anti-capitalist, whereas the left is traditionally just, it's anti-capitalist, but it's also often pro-business as well in its own odd ways. So I think there's a lot of common ground that we can really stress. I also think that I think in America in particular, there's a lot of talking points that would be traditionally viewed as on the left, which are really, to my opinion, on the right, personally, but were used by the Democrats in from the 60s, 50s, 60s onwards, whatever, to kind of recruit people to their cause without actually servicing them, like, as you would in kind of a patron client relationship that you would normally have. And so essentially we have to kind of supplant that and say, we are your friends. We are the people who will help you when no one else will. And that, to me, that is the constituency where I see there's a lot of opportunity there. There's a lot of opportunity to discuss with people who are, as I would say before, people who are at that kind of point in their life where they have no home, they're renting, they are paycheck to paycheck, they've got medical conditions they can't treat because of big pharma. They're dissatisfied with the system. They hate the fact that their town is turning into basically Somalia. So we have so much opportunity around us, and that kind of combination of what people consider to be left wing but aren't really left wing talking points combined with our traditional right wing talking points is absolute dynamite. And it's why people are so scared of the right being the right, because when the right is actually talked in the way that the right normally should do historically, people have really flocked to it. They love the fact that we're we don't want to inhibit their lives in the sense that we don't want to, have some kind of draconian rule. You can't do this, you can't do that all the time. But rather, there are rules. You follow the rules. The rest of it is up to you. We trust you. But at the same time, you do what is in the common interest, generally speaking. And there are just guidelines, for lack of a better term. And I think that's what we really have to offer. We have to offer people a vision of the future. And we also have to offer them a diagnosis of the problem, as well as ways to kind of, alternative ways of life to help themselves, self-reliance, go out, join one of these emergent communities, go join a group, go join a club, hang out online with guys, go join, go chat to people, do whatever. We have to offer things. And by doing that, and we're doing it increasingly so, I think we're going to get to the point where we're absorbing parts of the left, we're absorbing the good parts of the left. We're not having the bad parts. We're going to absorb a lot of the good parts, and we're going to absorb whatever is left of MAGA that after Trump's inevitable failure. If you want to put me to that bluntly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll just add one quick thing before Flood jumps in. It's going to be very interesting because when I agree, MAGA is doomed to fail. It's going to be sabotaged from within. Any good that he's going to try to do, I think he does have some nationalistic instincts. And you brought up a great point too, Carl, that Trump is a strong man, and Americans do like that. But once that all falls apart, and it's already happening, and I think we're going to get a morality play here of how bad tariffs are and how bad nationalism is here with Trump in the end game. But once that falls apart, the urge or the instinct or the desire that brought Trump to power is not going to go away. It's going to actually intensify because people are going to realize they got played, they got duped, and they're going to be angry, and they're going to be looking for an alternative to voting harder or voting for the next Zionist puppet. So I think it will be in a very interesting place because we're going to have such a huge swath of Americans that are disenchanted with the current political system at a level we've never seen before.
Very good point.
Great point. Who wants to jump in? Flood, then Carl, do you want to respond?
I don't mind. I generally want to agree. I think that we should take the dubs. I think we should take wins anywhere that we have common ground with these people. I think Carl really hit it on the head. He said two words that really ring like a bell to me. And that was common interest. And that's actually where I disagree with alliances, particularly with the hard left. And that is because, and this may be unpopular, but the fact is that they're anti-white and they're always going to be anti-white. And this is one of the things that I think we should not give up any ground on, is that we want a white nation when this is said and done. And I'm not really willing to share it with a bunch of fucking niggers that don't like us, right? And we've seen this week. And I don't believe in alliances just based on that. I don't think we have the same common interest, even though a lot of our goals do overlap. And I think that we should, like Carl said, in those situations where we can achieve some bit of unity, we need to have the control of those situations. We need to have the driving philosophy behind it. And that needs to be a pro-white philosophy. And anywhere that we don't or we can't agree, we need to, firmly stand behind, our ideal, which is a future for white children.
Well stated. Carl, was there anything you'd like to add?
Nope. I think it was also very succinctly stated by both Dave and by Flood there.
Great. Well, I agree. And I'd like to get your thoughts. And I hope the three of you will be willing to come back regularly. This has been very, very inspirational to have an adult discussion with men who are thinkers and aren't sociopaths and don't have to hear themselves talk and be right all the time. Very refreshing. So, in my mind, something that's been really underreported for the last 17 years or so is the power of this psyop mind control and entrancement that comes from social media. And very few people talk about this this gay psychopathic Jew, Peter Thiel, and his Palantir technology company, and how ingrained it is in so many aspects of the military-industrial complex and the spook community within the federal government in the United States. And then you've got this other guy who's really a nut. His name is, let's see where I have the article open here. Curtis Yarvin, who calls himself like...
say Yarvin, I knew it.
Curtis Yarvin, who calls himself like, something Mole Goldbug Moleberg or whatever. I don't know. And this guy is just a nut, man. And he publicly espouses this dark enlightenment and everything. And I mean, these guys, because so few people understood the power of social media and the power of this swiftly changing technology, you know, your phone is now a little computer, and these people are just hooked on it all, and the dopamine rush of, oh, I got 1,000 likes, oh boy, I'm gonna take a tablespoon of cinnamon, oh, that was a bad idea, I'm dying, and all this insanity, Carl. But this is all, I don't think this is organic in how this is all playing out. I think this is a very sick, dark strategy. So your thoughts?
I think it's a combination. I think it was designed. I mean, I'm old enough to remember from the early days of the internet. I'm sure you all are as well. When the leftists and whatever were talking about this, they were talking about how they believe that getting the internet to the right wing, that it was their way. They were going to educate us about, you know, truth, and there would be no more right wing because all these people, all of us would be educated by their views because we were all ignorant savages, so on and so forth. So essentially what I see is, I would agree that it was designed as a technology originally for different reasons, but then it's become kind of a golem. It's a golem which has gone out of control and is now eating its owners alive. It used that Jewish story about the golem of basically they created something they thought was a great idea, and then it's become and evolved into something completely different. It's like that. Do you remember that old robot they put on Twitter, old Twitter, Tay? They put Tay on Twitter, and within a day she was like screaming out Hitler. So it was that whole thing of they don't think ahead. They just assume, okay, well, if we give them more dopamine, they're going to do this. It's like porn. They gave us lots and lots of porn. There's Jews at every level of the porn industry historically. And then you suddenly got to this point now where there's mass availability of porn, but people are should be more addicted than ever, but people are walking away from it. People are increasingly walking away from it, saying, I don't want anything to do with this. This is bad for me. And I know it's bad for me. So I'm going to do something about it. What they've never really gotten is that there is an evolutionary response to any of these stratagems. Yes, they might try and make us quiescent, but they, at the same time, they inoculate us against their own bullshit and their own tactics and strategy by just exposing us to it in like vast amounts. It's not like, it comes back to what Dave was saying around the whole thing of, you know, it's a drip feed behind the scenes. It's the small amounts of medicine go down, so to speak. But when it's like in your face, full bore, it's just, you just throw up basically. And that's what's happening. We're throwing up and we're finding different ways around it. And we're using it against them.
Wow. Great point. Flood, your thoughts, then we'll go to Dave Scorpio.
I see Yarvin as he sees himself as an intellectual. I don't really see that. I see Yarvin as a body snatcher Jew. They're basically trying to reframe, basically communist tech Jews as right-wing Jews, which they're not. I mean, Yarvin wants the destruction of all of the same institutions that the commies want. He believes that we should have a king or a Caesar, because that's how companies are run. It's a very kind of, to me, it's kind of a crazy Jew kind of mentality where you're just a communist framing yourself as an anti-communist. But right. He's very, very sinister in the way that he's doing it because they're trying to frame the hard right out, right? He's trying to frame these so-called right-wing tech Jews as the real right wing. And that not only it doesn't just marginalize us, it frames us completely out of the picture where anything could be done to people like us. But we need to resist the idea that a Jew that wants to tear everything down is some sort of right winger, because it's just absurd. And I don't really think he's that intellectual at all.
Great point. Scorpio, your thoughts?
Well, great points by both guys. Carl, you brought the point of that there's an evolution that happens to any stratagem. I totally agree with that. And it also kind of converges with this idea of the law of unintended consequences. So the Jew does something. It's a great idea. We'll win this way. And then something happens that they don't expect, or that nobody expected. And that you could call that a divine force. You could call it God. You could call it help from the beyond. But that I do believe that kind of interaction is only going to increase, where things happen that nobody expected. And I do think the rate of change is going to inevitably increase no matter what happens. The rate of change is going to increase. And I think there's another esoteric thing here when we talk about technology, which is I think you can easily make the argument that there is much more advanced technology that's kept under wraps, and we are being sort of, fed breadcrumbs of this technology as these kind of secretive groups see fit. And the real question is, who created this technology originally? And who is in charge of sort of dribbling it out, and what's the hidden agenda behind that? And, going back to your original point, social media is a double-edged sword because, it's created narcissism. It's created the disgusting Jew operation known as OnlyFans.
Right.
Where thousands of young women are being, sucked into essentially being, in the porn industry and ruining their themselves and their aura, everything about them. But conversely, you have sort of viral expression of all this horrific Jewish crime that's going on, and how the Jew is being openly named almost everywhere. And I kind of, someone like Tucker Carlson, who you can make plenty of criticisms about, he's said in a recent tweet or X that anyone who supports a war with Iran is an enemy of America. And that's getting perilously close to naming the Jew. And I'm convinced Tucker knows it's the Jews. He's just not willing to admit it publicly. But a WASPy guy like him, that's in the upper crust of society his entire life, he has got to know who's behind all of this. And he is becoming perilously close to admitting it. So in closing, I'm optimistic in a lot of ways. That's why I've been fighting this notion to be black-pilled and, just wait for the collapse and then we'll have our day. That's not a strategy. There's a lot of good things that are happening, and I think a lot of things are on our side inevitably, that it's just a matter of time ticking away. We talked about the Holocaust earlier and some of these other things. It's already baked in the cake. There's no going back to the Jews being seen as victims. That's never going to happen, no matter how much they try. In fact, the more they try, the more they reveal themselves to be the victimizers.
Oh, great points. And since we're coming to the final few minutes of the show, Dave, we'll consider that to be your closing statement. Everybody should follow Dave Scorpio on Twitter X. David Scorpio 33 is his handle. And then from there, you can get to Dave's Substack and you can check out some of his very gifted political cartoons and some of his paintings as well. And soon, once Dave's real life settles down a little bit, he's going to be doing his own show on FTJ Media, which will be a great, great thing to tune into. So, Dave, as always, you You brought the pain known as truth, and let's go now to final thoughts by Flood, and then we want to give the final word to the brilliant Carl Rattle.
Thank you. I would just say thanks to all three of you, brilliant gentlemen, for sitting down for this wonderful conversation. I look forward to having Carl on my show on Monday, and you can find me, OMG It's Flood, on Twitter, as well as on ftjmedia.com and white-pilled.tv, among other places, but those are two of the best places. Come check out those free speech platforms if you're out there. And yeah, you can find me all over the place. I do a daily show from 8 to 11, sometimes a.m. and every day p.m.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I mean, you're such a prolific content creator, as well as the commitment you made to doing the audiobooks and the movies, like the Odyssey you recently released, which was just hilarious.
Olympia,
Olympia, I'm sorry. Your classic dry humor, it was just it was so funny. And I just really, really salute you, Roman Bellamy, for everything you do, Flood. You're a real hero to a lot of people, and I know a lot, because you were good at doing all this. You got a lot of attacks, and I'm glad to see that you have triumphed or vanquished all the ankle biters who dared to take on the mighty Flood. And it's been a very enjoyable witnessing how you systematically just shred them. But the final word, Carl, I'd like to give to you, and you know, don't worry about time. We don't have to end exactly at 3, but I'd like to get your final. There's so many other ideas I wanted to cover. Hopefully you three guys will be back next month. Maybe we can even make it a monthly thing. But it seems to me, Carl, that the white people, the silent majority, have the last, you know, a couple of years, it's been building up and building up. And this crazy Negroid who stabbed this young white twin, and all they basically, the reality is the lying left and the lying sub-Saharans are all about framing this poor black boy. He's a victim. You know, I mean, the Negroids are second only to the Jews in victimhood. But you know what? People are having enough. And if you see, all three of you guys have probably seen the venom and the anger that's pouring forth from whites over this psychopath little weasel. He clearly went and sat there trying to hope something would happen. He brought a knife. He clearly wanted to knife Whitey. I don't think he wanted to murder. I think he just wanted to gain his street cred, or maybe he didn't want to murder a white kid. But I'm encouraged, Carl, to see that the silent majority is finally waking up and seeing who the real enemies of this country are, which of course are the Jew, the black, the MS-13 mestizo Indian, all the Asians and Chinese that are flooding, the Muslims. It's insane that we allow these Jew lies of we're a melting point made up by a Jew, false, that diversity is our greatest strength. That's like, that makes me sick that people believe that. And so your final thoughts, Carl?
My final thoughts are relatively simple, is that in many respects, when we look at the past, look at the future, we always forget that what we do now, every day, is what echoes in eternity. It is not, you know, some inevitable process necessarily that causes everything. It's the little things we do every single day. You know, the only reason that a lot of the stuff on what happened with the black kid and the white guy has really gotten the traction it's gotten is because people have taken that and they've run with it, and they've not let it drop. The same way as, like, if that concept of action is so important. If you do something, it can be a small thing. It can be, you know, you shop at a different store. You cut that toxic black guy that you knew in college out of your life completely. Right. You say, you know, you say, no, I'm not gonna talk to my sister who's got an interracial relationship, or your brother who's had a homosexual marriage. You take actions in your own life. These cumulatively add up to things which are creating a revolutionary moment in the United States and elsewhere.
So at the end of the day, it's not just about, you know, it's going to happen, you know, okay, I can sit back, whatever. We can't sit on our loins. We must keep pushing. And the harder we push, the more we push, the better we push, the more we are, the quicker and the more we are going to succeed. And the more we succeed, the easier it all gets. Because as we all know, it's damn hard to push a boulder uphill, but once it starts going downhill, it becomes a heck of a lot easier. So we're getting to the downhill point now. Let's keep pushing. Let's not allow us to be distracted. Let's focus on getting the message out there, making sure it's consistent. Let's not give in to compromise, and let's just push hard. And there is no solution but a white America and a white Europe, a white Australia, and for the Boers in South Africa to be safe. That is the future. That is, and it's that simple to me.
Oh man, amen. I got to tell you, I do a lot of superior shows, but this has been a great show, and I want to thank you three fellas. It was just an honor to be participate. I want to point out, if you're not following at KARLRADL at Carl Rattle on Twitter, your ex, you're really making a mistake. And go to Carl's Substack, which is carlrattle14.substack.com, and sign up. And this fella is a gift to the white movement, and we got to get him lots more exposure. And Flood, Bellamy, Roman, salute to you for bringing him to FTJ and your own various other platforms, White Pill TV, et cetera, et cetera. And we have to really, really get lots more people to understand and follow Carl. And with that being said, don't forget, Flood's on every night. Some days it's 8 to 11 a.m., 8 to 11 p.m. And then don't forget all the other great hosts, Davis, Lerman, Nick, Night Nation Review, Nick every night, Ballbusters, Daniel Christos, and the list goes on and on. You can check it out for yourself at ftjmedia.com. And don't forget to go to Money Tree Publishing. We talk so much about reading books, and I think Carl wins, but I have read, you know, thousands and thousands in my life, and I continue to do so. And there's some great books at moneytreepublishing.com and Dave Gahari's imprint. And if you're into conspiracy, moonrockbooks.com, and use the code G-Man at moneytreepublishing.com, which you can now buy with crypto, which is pretty cool. Dave's entered the 21st century, which is very cool. And he soon will have, if not already, also a processor finally. So it makes it easy for you to get the kind of books like the Siege Anthology, the 6 Million Factor Fiction, the Myth of German Villainy, the Stalag edition of Mein Kampf, which is another excellent one, Henry Ford's 2-volume. He paid literally millions of dollars in the 19-teens for the best journalists in the country to cover what the International Jew is doing. And it resonates so well to this day. So you should really own some more books, and the ones at Money Tree Publishing are great. Again, you save 10% with the code G-M-A-N, G-Man. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and I'm glad FTJ is back up and running now. And I'll download the complete show and upload it there, so when you go back, if you missed the first hour because of the upgrade, it'll be there for you to watch as a replay. So again, support all the talented and brilliant FTJ hosts. Support Carl Rattle. And I'll be back Friday. I didn't really like how some of the co-hosts, Statutory Fall, was stepping all over Les Borey. So Les is coming back this Friday with me and Zach Logos Revealed, and want to give him a full platform to outline his noble effort to become elected to the national Canadian government. I think they call it the parliament. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. But anyway, he would be the right guy to get elected after the injustice of him